December 20, 2005, episode number 7.
This is a Slaga podcast.
Meep meep.
Hello everybody, this is Paul Canapacki again, somewhere still in the Midwest. This is the fastest turnaround I've had between podcasts. It's been 7 days since the last podcast and 6 hours since the actual podcast took place in my living room. I sat down with Glenn Nash to have some pizza and talk about the good old days of geocaching, how the Slaga website came about through the years, and the challenges that Glenn has being a geocaching.com cache approver.
Here we are in Kitchen of Paul Canapacki, and I have Glenn Nash on the other side of the microphone, and we're going to do a little podcast here to find out who Glenn is.
How you doing, Paul? Good afternoon, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it a great day for a podcast?
I was told to be exciting and energetic, and I can tell you that that's not going to last very long.
Okay. You can stop now.
I grew up pretty much in St. Louis, went to school in St. Louis, and Hillsdale, if anybody knows where Hillsdale is, they've been in the news lately. Went to school in Normandy and went off to college in Florida State, came back to St. Louis. Currently married and have 6 kids. The 2 youngest ones are getting ready to start school, start college, and the older ones are off onto their
own. When you were in Florida State, did you go to school to get into the health profession?
Pretty much that was the case. I was in the pre-med program, so I majored in biology and chemistry and math and all that stuff that the pre-med majors had to do. And for some reason, my roommate and myself decided in the middle of winter to come to St. Louis to get out of the cold. And we came right into the middle of an ice storm and thought that was a good idea. So that's how I came here, or came back here. And for some reason, never went back to Florida State to finish up.
Okay. Still pursued the health profession and became a
respiratory care practitioner. The name keeps changing. Yeah. Well, the whole time I was in school, I'd been working in the hospital because working in the hospital is not that hard. It's a little easier than loading boxes at UPS, you know, so that was always a easy way to make some money and not have to work all that hard.
If you're looking to make a difference, that's one place where you could probably at the end of the day realize that you probably did something good.
There are a lot of days where pretty satisfying leaving work.
In addition to working in the hospital, and besides geocaching, is there any other hobbies you have or interests that you have?
Before I got into geocaching, most of the folks I hung around with were long-distance endurance motorcycle riders. Yeah, most of my friends were long-distance motorcycle riders, so I hung around those guys and did that a bit, played with the motorcycles.
Well, who are these people called the chatty morons?
Those are some of the motorcycle people. pretty much an irreverent bunch of folks that continually got in trouble on the big long-distance motorcycle list for one reason or another. We kept getting kicked off. So we formed our own list, and so we couldn't get kicked off our own list. So we thought we had a deal. So that's what the chatty morons are. There's about 30 of us, I guess.
And that's still strong, going strong in
existence. Absolutely, going strong.
And you maintain that that list on the internet?
I don't maintain the chatty moron list. That's okay. One of the other morons.
Okay.
It is and chatty because they're a pretty chatty bunch. I get probably 300 or 400 emails a day. Most of them are generated by the 30 or morons. That's with a capital M, by the way.
Okay.
Morons.
Besides just talking to the news group throughout the year, you have events, which includes long-distance bike rides.
We went to Texas. They had there was the Waltz Across Texas, which was a two-day rally down there. And all the proceeds from that benefited the Shriners Children's Hospital, I believe.
Okay.
So they ended up raising quite a bit of money for the hospital. So part of the fee was a donation towards the hospital.
Okay. And you're still riding bikes these days?
No, because I sold my motorcycle too. another friend who needed an engine for a motor transplant, and I just happened to have the motor that he needed, so I donated my motor to his motorcycle.
And you visit it every once in a while. You get a card from it for Christmas.
That's
for
exactly
thanks for
right.
the organs.
That's exactly right. So the plan was to have another motorcycle, but that plan didn't work. So right now I'm motorcycle-less.
These are not the racing motorcycles. These are touring bikes.
Mostly touring bikes that that can go long distances relatively comfortably.
Years ago, you started a website, which has become the Slaga website after many, many years, but I think you were the one who started the website in the first place. And that probably revolves around the whole discussion about how did you get into geocaching and where did it go from there?
Yes, indeed. One of my moron buddies popped off an email after they saw the geocaching site and said, this is what we do. You know, because the rallies are pretty much you ride to a place and you find a location, which would kind of be like a virtual cache. You'd have to maybe visit the beer-drinking goat, which happens to be the mayor of this little town, I think in Mexico, or, you know, find all these oddball locations, and each location is, you know, on the route somewhere, and they're all different point levels, and you determine your route, and you go find all your locations, and you go back to the rally starting point and see if you got enough points to win. Well, you know, she popped off a note that said, this is what we do. I checked it out and said, yeah, this is just like what we do, only without the motorcycles. So I found a couple of caches that happened to be close to the house and went out and found three or four caches the first day and a couple more caches the next day, and this was pretty neat.
You bought a GPS at that time, or you had one already?
I'd already had one.
Okay. Use it when you were traveling on the motorcycle trips?
Correct.
Okay.
I had actually a couple. I had a Magellan 2000 XL. But, of course, it was never in the right place at the right time. And then I got a Street Pilot for the car, which is kind of a big GPS, and used it, for 100 or more caches. You know, and it's, you know, compared to the E-Trexes, these Street Pilots are huge. So we love that thing all over the place.
It's normally meant to sit on your dashboard in your car.
Exactly.
That you can see from a distance, and the screen is really big.
Really big.
Okay.
So we got kind of a neck strap and carried it around, and that worked pretty good, you know, surprisingly. Street Pilot is still in the car. I think it's underneath the seat right now. And then I have an E-Trex Vista that I use most of the time. I'm having trouble with the E-Trex, that the screen is too little. Once it gets in the evening, I can't see the screen anymore.
But your still works even after losing it in the washing machine?
I've washed it a couple times. It's very clean. Being small, you know, it gets, well, I put it in my pocket, and then it just went through the washing machine. And it worked real well after that.
I think Garmin should hire you to do like a Timex commercial. Take a look at
yeah. With the Street Pilot took a little trip in the 11-point river. It didn't survive that very well, so had to send it back. They gave me a new one.
So back to the website.
After geocaching for a while, I noticed there had to be a way to communicate with the other cachers in town, because there was a cache out here in Pacific called Chain Mail that was unavailable, and somebody said that it was missing, and so the cache owner archived it. Well, I went out and looked for it, and it was right there where it was before. But I couldn't tell anybody because I couldn't make a note on the cache page. Nobody would see the note if I made the note. So I posted some notes on some other cache pages, but quickly realized that nobody was going to see those unless they were looking at those particular cache pages. So there had to be a way to communicate in town to other cachers that they would see. So I started a cache page called The Local News.
Ah, yes, which I think is still a cache out there?
It's still active, and I get grief about that every now and again because it's not a cache.
It's not a findable cache.
It's not a findable cache. It's not even a virtual cache. What are we doing with this page?
It was just meant to be used as a place where people could go and add comments.
Comments.
Discussion, basically.
A little bulletin board for the cachers. It was also kind of a portal to the St. Louis area group that was starting to kind of get together at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we used it for a bulletin board message center for a number of months until the cache pages got so big with so many messages on it, it took like 2 days to load.
And I think that was before they implemented the paging feature, so that if you were going to look at that web, that cache page, every comment that it ever made had to be loaded.
Exactly.
Being paged over time.
And it got to be 500 or 600 posts, and I kept trimming it down to a couple of hundred posts. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon I realized that just wasn't going to work very well. So I went in search of some other communication sort of thing and came up with an email list. And I wanted a free one because I'm just cheap. And found the free list, geocaching list, or actually just the free list mail service, and I made a news group called Geocaching that we started using as something handy between like 4 or 5 people or 6 people in town. Uh-huh. And now it's gotten out of control, and there's 280 people on it, and that's sort of like the main communication of the St. Louis folks.
Right. I think you would kind of consider it an electronic water cooler to get a pulse of exactly what's happening now, what are the current issues, and it has become a vehicle for quick decisions to have a lunch. Tuesday, I want to have a lunch on Friday, and within a couple of days, people have said, I'm going to be there, we figure out a time, and it's done. It all happens on that free list news group.
Online and very quickly. Or in my case, it's 10 o'clock and I'm hungry at 11. I'm going to be here and see who shows up. And usually one or two people will show up.
Yeah.
But along with that free list, mail list service, they also had a little portal page that you could put up like a one-page web page to introduce your list of whatever it was. And that was the start of what is now the Sligo website. I ran that for a little while, until it was obvious I pretty much didn't know anything about how to do a web page, and it had grown to the point where we really need somebody that was way more professional than I was that could make this website grow into something really neat, and that's where you came in. And you took it and...
I stole it from you and...
grew it into what it is today.
I either stole it from you or Island Dave. I don't remember who stole it from who, but...
Actually, Island Dave set it up, bought a domain name and set it up and sort of imported everything over there, and then you took it from there.
Yeah, we've exchanged webmaster duties off and on throughout the life of the site, but you decided there was still something missing from a communication standpoint with the landowners, as well as something that was more Missouri-centric rather than just the St. Louis area. Must have been a need to have the communication at the whole state level. So Mogeo came into existence, and you are back being webmaster.
Back being webmaster again, and I pretty much don't know anything more now than I did before, but I have a website. When we first started the Slaga list, we had sort of contemplated making a Missouri website or a Missouri organization or list, and then we thought that was pretty bold, you know, grabbing all of the whole state, because there were folks in Kansas City and a few folks in Columbia, and we sort of decided not to really want to speak for them in the St. Louis area. So that's how Sligo came around, just being St. Louis. But after we grew for a while, there was a need for more of a statewide communication, coordination sort of thing, a listing of land management policies and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. So I started the Missouri Geocaches Association, to kind of address that and to try and maybe tie the three or four groups in the state together to give everybody sort of a home and a place that they could call home, you know. Because in St. Louis we had SLAGA, and we were all at home with SLAGA, but the rest of the state didn't have a place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at a place.
So Kansas City has set up residents in the forums on Mogia. They are one of the most active Missouri group that uses the forums.
Correct.
At Mogia.
For some reason, the Kansas City folks didn't like the email list, the free list sort of structure. They had one. A cacher set up a free list forum, but they never used it. And as soon as I opened up the forums on the Mogia list, you know, the Mogia forums, they just took to that like nobody's business. And I think now there's close to 300 caches on the forums, and we've posted like, I don't know, 45,000 posts. I mean, it's huge, and it's very active. Mm. Surprisingly enough, we're getting more and more folks from Kansas sign up. Mm. So Kansas has kind of adopted the Mogia forum, and
okay.
Now they call it the Mocan forum because we don't want to leave them out. And when I was reviewing caches for Kansas, you know, it just kind of seemed like a natural thing that they would want to come along, and that's a place for them too. It's actually a place for everybody. Funny, different groups around the country, what they prefer, and I think we prefer the news group, the email list here, just because that's how we started and that's what everybody's used to. But there are other places in the country that are just the opposite. Everything is done on the forums, and they can't make an email list work or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of what you get used to. I prefer email. I like to have the mail come to me in my little inbox, and I can read it and respond to it. But the forums, I have to actively go someplace, you know, and sign in and do all that.
I'm probably one of the few people who read this free list geocaching news group, but do not actually have any of the messages go into my inbox. I actually go to the archives online. I just have a link on my browser. I click on it, scroll to the bottom. Anything that isn't highlighted is something I haven't read yet. And I pick the first one on the list I haven't read, and I just say date next until I'm through.
The archives, the archive feature is very handy. Mm-hmm. People forget that it's there, so they can say things in the emails that, you know, that look like it's just kind of going between a group of people, but it's really posted on the internet for everybody to see.
Right. And you can prove that sometimes just by going to Google. And if you posted your cell phone number, you might actually find it showing up in your Google search.
It's there. If I get to the messages quickly, I can delete them out of the archives, but I don't think I've ever deleted anything because it's a pretty short time window, and I forget about it.
You said something about approving caches for the Kansas City area. A rumor is it that you're a geocaching.com admin. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It actually does take a lot of time, but it's pretty fun. I was trying to think back of when I first started reviewing caches, February or March of 2003, I think. So it's almost been 3 years. I started with Missouri, and then we added Southern Illinois, because Illinois didn't have their own reviewer. So I took all of Southern Illinois and then Kansas, sometimes Arkansas. I did the Pacific Northwest for a little while they were having some changes. But I was pretty much asked to do it. A lot of people always try and volunteer for the job, and it pretty much doesn't work that way.
Mm.
So for some reason or another, I was already fairly well known to some of the reviewers and to Groundspeak, probably because I complained a lot about this and that. And at that particular time, we were having some trouble in St. Louis, and I said, you know, we really need to have some local representation. We've grown enough here that, you know, somebody around here ought to do it. And I didn't hear anything back for a little while. And they wrote back and said, Congratulations. You have a new job. So then I sat at home for a week waiting for something to happen. And they forgot to tell me how to do it.
Oh.
So I was waiting for like things to come into my inbox or something. Like how caches, I had no idea how caches were reviewed and posted on the website. I thought it was like magic or something.
How many caches did you put out as just a placer before you became an admin?
10, maybe.
Okay.
I think
so. You had gone through the process, approval process yourself. Had you had any problems putting any of your own caches out before you became an admin?
Pretty much not. They went fairly smoothly. Back in the olden days, I mean, you could strap an ammo box to a train trestle, and that was great fun. Nobody said anything. Maybe this is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was all good.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, we can't do that now.
The biggest challenge in my mind that if somebody wants to put something somewhere and you need to tell them that you can't because of this or this or this.
Correct.
Dealing with that or convincing them that would be the toughest part of the job as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly right. How to be tactful and, you know, still get the point across that, you know, having a cache at the airport, you know, we really can't do anymore. A cache in the school grounds, you know, we really can't do anymore. Stuff like that. The 1/10 of a mile, depending on where we are, does kick in a lot, and that's a problem. For the most part, things go fairly smoothly.
You used to be able to put in a set of coordinates, and once the cache got approved, you could go in and change those coordinates to anything else you wanted to, and you wouldn't have to get it approved again. But I think that is no longer the case. Someone who's trying to get something past the guideline can't change the coordinates at will after it's been approved, because it may have to go back into the cache approving queue if its coordinates have changed too much.
Exactly correct. They found one of the little loopholes that we used a couple of times to put caches where they really shouldn't be. And we could, you know, like you said, once a cache was reviewed and published, you could move the thing all over the place and, you know, put it back out at the airport underneath the bridge. Where it shouldn't be. But now I think it's, you can move it around a couple tenths of a mile. If an area is starting to show some wear, you can change its location a little bit. But if you radically move it, then it won't let you do it.
In order to get a multi-stage cache approved, the cache placer has to provide all the coordinates of all the stages.
Absolutely.
Cache.
Because, you know, again, back in the olden days, nobody cared about the intermittent waypoints, and nobody really cared where the thing ended up. You know, we knew where the parking lot was, where the coordinates were, but we really never knew where it went. And we had some that ended up back where, you know, you shouldn't be again. Do a multi-cache and then land it in a wilderness area, for example. We started asking for all the waypoints, and that's been for quite a while. Back in 03 or 04, I started asking for those.
I mean, if I want to put a cache in a Missouri State Park, you're not going to check up on somebody's, whether they fill a permit out or not. You're going to...
Yes, we do, actually.
You do? Okay. Let me go change some things. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Actually, it would be nice if cachers would have already filled out the permits and got the permissions and stuff. But in reality, most of the time, folks that are placing their caches have never placed one, perhaps in a state park, and they don't know that they have to get a permit. And they don't know who to ask, you know, even if they did know that they had to get a permit. Wow. So stuff gets submitted, it comes to me, and then I sort of get them back in the right direction. The Department of Natural Resources actually does keep track of all the caches in the state parks, and when I get a cache submission that looks like it's in a state park, a lot of times I'll contact Barb Wilson, who's the director of the geocaching program for the Department of Natural Resources. A lot of times she'll say, well, you know, that's not in one of our parks. Oh, great. Mm. Or, you know, this one actually is, and now we have to go back and try and get the permits. So we do contact back and forth, and they keep track of the caches. If they go through and they say, well, I've got a permit, and you know, Bob said it's okay, I don't ask for a permit number. But when the cache page goes to Barb, they know.
Okay. Besides approving caches, there's also a process that you must go through to see if a cache needs to be archived for various reasons. Either it's the permit has run out, or enough people have not found it, or they've reported it as being in poor condition and it has not been maintained in a while. Is that a specific geocaching policy within geocaching.com, or is it up to each admin to determine within their designated area? I think it's about time I go and look and clean up some of these caches.
For a long time, it was thought that once the cache was out and listed and, you know, people were finding it, that everything was the geocacher's responsibility to maintain their cache. So for a long time, the reviewers didn't look at caches that had turned to junk, and nobody's found them, nobody questioned. We just sort of figured that that's not our responsibility. I think when I started reviewing Missouri, I loaded everything into GSAC and started looking at all the caches that were wet and turned to junk and nobody's found them in a year. And I started asking the cache owners if it's still a cache, and you know, got rid of a lot of junk and stuff like that. So I think most everybody does it now.
I think the ability for a person to log a cache with an icon that has an X in it, which is basically suggested be archived.
Correct.
Now, obviously, that can be abused as well. If somebody just doesn't like the cache, they can say that.
Right.
But if there are enough of those, usually they are accompanied by a log that explains the reason for wanting to archive it, and that may be the red flag that helps geocaching.com decide whether they need to take some type of action or not.
That is one of the red flags. A lot of folks think that the reviewers see every log from every cache in the state, and that we read them, and we can obviously see that, you know, there was a cache in the middle of Missouri somewhere that had three logs that said that the log was wet, and I would know that. Reality is, I don't see those logs. I spend a fair amount of time kind of reading logs and stuff, and if I see a pattern, I'll put a note. But what catches my attention very quickly is what you mentioned, is that red should be archived log. That one comes directly to me. Oh. So I see that one, and then I can go take a look and, you know, discover that, you know, it's been wet for a year and we should do something else. And then I'll post the little your cache is turning to trash note and
politically maybe, correct warning number one.
Yeah. You know, maybe you should go check up on it. Because what we really don't want, and from my view, is we just don't want to have a lot of trash laying around. And it happens, you know, caches get wet and people get busy and they don't get out to look at their stuff and replace things. And if we give them a little nudge, sometimes things will get cleaned up fairly quickly.
The efforts by yourself and the geocaches in the St. Louis area has helped St. Louis get a reputation for having good caches.
I think that's true.
So, okay.
I've gotten a lot of emails from folks that like to come here because of the diversity, and most of the caches are in pretty good shape.
Because of the weather in our part of the world, we have different challenges. Whereas if you're in Florida and you always have humid and it's always wet, they have their own challenges of keeping their caches maintained.
Alligators.
Alligators. Yeah, I don't think we have too many caches that have been eaten around here. Now, they have been chewed up by bears and raccoons and squirrels, but each area has its own little issue to deal with.
But the reviewers, we don't approve caches. You know, in the olden days, we used to approve. In reality, I approve of everything. But what we do is we review and list, because that's the politically correct thing now is... We review the caches and then list them on the site. A lot of folks have asked, well, how come I'm allowing such goofy things to happen? I'm pretty powerless over what kind of caches get placed and how many of what kind of caches get placed and all of that kind of stuff. If they meet the guidelines, then pretty much they get published. Mm-hmm. It's the peer pressure and the local organizations that really have a lot more power over the caching environment than the reviewer, because we all have our pet peeves and we all have our caches that we don't like.
Right.
But my personal preference sort of doesn't play into whether or not a cache gets listed.
Okay. If that were the case, there would be no micros in St. Louis.
Well,
you don't have to answer that.
There would be fewer, but micros are a good alternative to a cache size where they have to be used. What really is kind of a pet peeve is using the micro size in a place where you could hide an army tank. Micros in an urban setting where you can't hide a big cache. You know, there's some pretty clever micros.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the neatest caches I've seen are of the micro variety.
Right. I think that's probably where the challenge is, that to make something small and hidden in plain sight is more challenging than finding a rock bluff in the middle of nowhere, even though I appreciate the hike to get to that rock bluff in the mm-hmm. middle of nowhere. So, yeah, I think that the variety is good. As long as the quality continues to be good, then I'm happy in general.
Quality is a big issue. You know, and nobody likes lame caches, whatever lame caches are. But
right.
I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder and all of that.
Right. True.
Because there's a lot of folks that really enjoy the 7-mile hike through the wilderness, but there's a lot of people can't do that
right.
anymore.
And don't have the time.
Don't have the time. Micros provide something for those cachers to go find that they can't get out and do those long distance adventures.
Right. One thing I wanted to bring up, my first cache find was one called Ghost that was in Route 66 Park. That was one of the caches that Glenn put out. Didn't find it the first time. I went back right after that, found the cache. Are you still putting out caches? And what are some of the more memorable ones? I know we've adopted some good ones over time as a Slugger group.
Funny you should mention putting out more caches. I've got maybe 8 or 10 that I put out myself and another few that I've adopted. Somebody mentioned recently that it's about time I put out another, because it's been quite a long time since I've put one out. The Ghost cache was one of the first ones that we put out, and that was pretty interesting. We put out about 4 or 5 caches that day, and the Ghost cache was the last one. And it was hot, middle of I think July, must have been about 102 degrees, and we found the general area that we wanted, but it was so hot and we were so tired, we finally just said, just put it down here, we're done. Put it behind the bush, because I am tired, I want to go home. And that was deceptively easy, because it was right next to the grassy area, right behind a bush. And we thought that it would be so easy to find that it would be just incredible. But right next to the bush was a little path leading into the woods. So everybody got to where the path was and immediately went into the woods and couldn't find anything. Came back out to the grass to get bearings, went back into the woods, and they must have walked past it, you know, cache a dozen times before they looked down at their feet, and it was just sitting pretty much just right there. Mm-hmm. But it was in one of our camo containers, and it was kind of hard to see. I think eventually it got washed down to the river in a bit of a rain.
Mm-hmm.
So then I moved it. Ghost lived on for quite a while until it finally just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
That was after I moved it. Folks were still having trouble finding it, so I took a bunch of sticks and made a big arrow with sticks that pointed right to where the cache was. People said they found the arrow, but they still couldn't find the cache.
Another one I think I remember of yours was, and you might have adopted it, was Watchtower.
Watchtower was an adopted cache from a cacher that was active early on, WTMRN, old Walter. He had a cache at the tower, and when he retired, he let all his caches go, and I took I guess about five of his, and that was one of them.
There's also one down south by the Tom Sock area that's on a ledge. Is that one of his?
Yes, Royal Pain.
Royal Pain, yeah.
Royal Pain in the Royal Gorge. That cache is still there. It has fallen out of its hiding place once or twice, and Tidge Guy just recently put it back up on the ledge where it's supposed to be, but that one's pretty neat. That one involves a little bit of rock climbing.
What kind of caches are you looking for? What kind of ones that you put in your receiver that you go looking for when you have the time to actually hunt caches these days?
Most of the time anymore, I don't go caching by myself. Joanne will go with me, and she likes to do not the real easy ones, but half a mile walk in or out, so about a half hour per cache. The long multi-stage caches, you know, the 15-step multis, I don't do those very often. I'm not real good at puzzles.
Any of the Rich or Didge Guy caches that have come out lately, I think you have to pretty much rack your brain or
go with a group.
Yeah, go with a group and hope somebody else can figure it out first.
Round town, fast, easy caches, you know. They're nice. A nice walk in the park. Nothing too elaborate. Looking back at a lot of the caches I've placed, that's the kind of caches I've placed, too. The one up at Faust Park, you get to walk around the park a little bit, show the family the neat stuff, and then go back and, you know, find kind of an easy cache. I've not been real good at making elaborate puzzles.
From the first cache that you ever found to the one that you last found, you know, what has really changed over the time?
Well, there's a lot more caches now. When I first started caching, there were a handful of caches in town, and they were the traditional sort of, you go here, you find the trinket box, you sign the log, and you go to the next place. There's been a giant increase in creativity with the neat puzzles and the urban camouflage. Oh, that's pretty neat.
There is a tendency to try to outdo the next person, and what that ends up doing is making things very complicated and maybe limiting the number of people who end up doing your cache in the long run. So
that could be. If you're known for putting out real stumpers, you know, you're going to limit your audience to just those diehard people that know that they're going to find anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a fine line between being very creative and just being very frustrating. You know, because once you pass the point of it's so creative that you can't find it and the cacher tips over to frustration, then you have a, you know, destroy the earth, seek and destroy mode. I've been on a couple where halfway into the project, I'm trying to decide that if this is still fun anymore. It's like, what am I doing here? Because obviously I've just turned blind. Yes. Thorny Bush. I went to Thorny Bush Cache down in Forest Park. It must have been five or six times, and I was convinced that cache wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
People were finding it before me. People were finding it after me, and
right.
I go back down there, and I couldn't find it.
And anything. That was a joke after a while. I think we remember us joking about that you couldn't find it.
And I couldn't find it. I finally had to take Rich down there and finally did find it. And I'd been walking all over it. I just didn't see it. The cache is gone. Okay. That whole area has been redone.
Okay. Wasn't it hidden in a big tree over a creek?
Hidden in a tree over the creek.
Yeah.
I kept stooping under the tree to get to the other side of the tree rather than climbing up over it. If I climbed over it, I'd have stepped on it. But
yeah.
It's one of those that just frustrated me to no end, and it was an easy cache.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about yourself, things you've done in geocaching, and a little bit about what it takes to be a geocaching admin.
Well, thank you very much, and really enjoyed it. Give me a buzz, and we can podcast some more.
Okay.
Thanks again, Glenn.
This concludes the Slaga Podcast. For more information about the Slaga Group and geocaching in the St. Louis, Missouri area, go to www.geostl.com. Here's wishing you a strong signal and a trusty bearing.